In, Around, and Afterthoughts on Documentary Photography by Martha Rossler, 1981. The Bowery in New York is an archetypal skid row. It has been much photographed in works veering between outraged moral sensitivity and sheer slumming spectacle. Why is the Bowery so magnetic to documentarians? It is no longer possible to evoke the camouflaging impulses to, quote, help drunks and down-and-outers, or, quote, expose their dangerous existence. How can we deal with documentary photography itself as a photographic practice? What remains of it? We must begin with it as a historical phenomenon, a practice with a past. Documentary photography has come to represent the social conscience of liberal sensibility presented in visual imagery, though its roots are somewhat more diverse and include the quote-unquote artless control motives of police, record-keeping, and surveillance. Photo documentary as a public genre had its moment in the ideological climate of developing state liberalism and the attendant reform movements of the early 20th century progressive era in the United States, and withered along with the New Deal consensus sometime after the Second World War. Documentary, with its original muckraking associations, preceded the myth of journalistic objectivity and was partly strangled by it. We can reconstruct a past for documentary within which photographs of the Bowery might have been part of the aggressive insistence on the tangible reality of generalized poverty and despair, of enforced social marginality, and finally outright social uselessness. An insistence further that the ordered world of business as usual take account of that reality behind those images newly seen, a reality newly elevated into consideration simply by being photographed, and thus exemplified and made concrete. In The Making of an American, Jacob Riaz wrote, quote, "We used to go in the small hours of the morning to the worst tenements, and the sights I saw there gripped my heart until I felt that I must tell of them, or burst, or turn anarchist, or something. I wrote, but it seemed to make no impression. One morning, scanning my newspaper at the breakfast table, I put it down with an outcry that startled my wife, sitting opposite. There it was, the thing I had been looking for all those years, a four-line dispatch from somewhere in Germany. If I remember right, had it all. A way had been discovered, it ran, to take pictures by flashlight. The darkest corner might be photographed that way." End quote. In contrast to the pure sensationalism of much of the journalistic attention to working-class immigrant and slum life, the meliorism of Riaz, Lewis Hine, and others involved in social work propagandizing argued, through the presentation of images combined with other forms of discourse, for the rectification of wrongs. It did not perceive those wrongs as fundamental to the social system that tolerated them. The assumption that they were tolerated rather than bred marks a basic fallacy of social work. Reformers like Riaz and Margaret Sanger strongly appealed to the worry that the ravages of poverty, crime, immorality, prostitution, disease, radicalism, would threaten the health and security of polite society as well as to sympathy for the poor, and their appeals were often meant to awaken the self-interest of the privileged. The notion of charity argued for it far outweighs any call for self-help. Charity is an argument for the preservation of wealth, and reformist documentary, like the appeal for free and compulsory education, represented an argument within a class about the need to give a little in order to mollify the dangerous classes below, an argument embedded in a matrix of Christian ethics. Documentary photography has been much more comfortable in the company of moralism than wedded to a rhetoric or program of revolutionary politics. Even the bulk of work of the U.S. version of the Workers' Film and Photo League of the Depression era shared in the muted rhetoric of the Popular Front. Yet the force of documentary surely derives in part from the fact that the images might be more decisively unsettling than the arguments enveloping them. Arguments for reform, threatening to the social order as they might seem to the unconvinced, must have come as a relief from the potential arguments embedded in the images. With the manifold possibilities for radical demands that photos of poverty and degradation suggest, any coherent argument for reform is ultimately both polite and negotiable. Odious, perhaps, but manageable. It is, after all, social discourse. As such, these arguments were surrounded and institutionalized into the very structures of government. The newly created institutions, however, began to prove their inadequacy, even to their own limited purpose, almost as soon as they were erected. Let us consider the Bowery again, the site of victim photography in which the victims, insofar as they are now victims of the camera, that is, of the photographer, are often docile, whether through mental confusion or because they are just lying there unconscious. But if you should show up before they are sufficiently distracted by drink, you are likely to be met with hostility, for the men on the Bowery are not particularly interested in immorality and stardom, and they've had plenty of experience with the Nikon set. Especially now, the meaning of all such work, past and present, has changed. The liberal New Deal state has been dismantled piece by piece. The war on poverty has been called off, utopia has been abandoned, and liberalism itself has been deserted. Its vision of moral idealism spurring general social concern has been replaced with a mean-minded Spencerian sociobiology that suggests, among other things, that the poor may be poor through lack of merit. Read Harvard's Richard Herrnstein as well, of course, between Milton Friedman's lines. There is as yet no organized national left, only a right. There is not even drunkenness, only substance abuse, a problem of bureaucratic management. The exposé, the compassion and outrage of documentary, fueled by the dedication to reform, has shaded over into combinations of exoticism, tourism, voyeurism, psychologism and metaphysics, trophy hunting, and careerism. Yet documentary still exists, still functions socially in one way or another. Liberalism may have been routed, but its cultural expressions still survive. This mainstream documentary has achieved legitimacy and has a decidedly ritualistic character. It begins in glossy magazines and books, occasionally in newspapers, and becomes more expensive as it moves into art galleries and museums. The liberal documentary assuages any stirrings of conscience in its viewers, the way scratching relieves an itch, and simultaneously reassures them about their relative wealth and social position, especially the latter now that even the veneer of social concern has dropped away from the upwardly mobile and comfortable social sectors. Yet this reminder carries the germ of an inescapable anxiety about the future. It is both flattery and warning, as it always has been. Documentary is a little like horror movies, putting a face on fear and transforming threat into fantasy, into imagery. One can handle imagery by leaving it behind. It is them, not us. One may even, as a private person, support causes. Documentary, as we know it, carries old information about a group of powerless people to another group addressed as socially powerful. In the set piece of liberal television documentary, Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame, broadcast the day after Thanksgiving in 1960, Murrow closes with an appeal to the viewers, then a more restricted part of the population than at present, to write their congressmen to help the migrant farm workers whose pathetic, helpless, dispirited victimhood had been amply demonstrated for an hour. Not least by the documentary's aggressively probing style of interview, its quote-unquote higher purpose notwithstanding, because these people can do nothing for themselves. But which political battles have been fought and won by someone for someone else? Luckily, Cesar Chavez was not watching television, but rather, throughout that era, was patiently organizing farm workers to fight for themselves. This difference is reflected in the documentaries made by and for the Farm Workers Organizing Committee, later the United Farm Workers of America, AFL-CIO. Such works as Si Se Pueda, Yes We Can, and Decision at Delano, not radical works perhaps, but militant works. In the liberal documentary, poverty and oppression are almost invariably equated with misfortunes caused by natural disasters. Casualty is vague, blame is not assigned, Fate cannot be overcome. Liberal documentaries blames neither the victims nor their willful oppressors, unless they happen to be under the influence of our own global enemy, world communism. Like photos of children in pleas for donations to international charity organizations, liberal documentary implores us to look in the face of deprivation and to weep, and maybe to send money, if it is to some faraway place where the innocence of childhood poverty does not set off in us the train of thought that begins with denial and ends with welfare cheat. Even in the fading of liberal sentiments, one recognizes that it is impolite or dangerous to stare in person, as Dionne Arbus knew when she arranged her satisfyingly immobilized imagery as a surrogate for the real thing, the real freak show. With the appropriate object of view, one no longer feels obligated to suffer empathy. As 60s radical chic has given way to 80s pugnacious self-interest, one displays one's toughness in enduring a visual assault without a flinch, in jeering or in cheering. Beyond the spectacle of families in poverty, where starveling infants and despairing adults give the lie to any imagined hint of freedom and become merely the currently tedious poor, the way seems open for a subtle imputation of pathetic heroic choice to victims turned freaks, of the seizing of fate in straitened circumstances. The boring sociological becomes the exciting mythological / psychological. On this territory, a more or less overt sexualization of the photographic image is accomplished, pointing perhaps to the wellspring of identification that may be the source of this particular fascination. It is easy to understand why what has ceased to be news becomes testimonial to the bearer of the news. Documentary testifies finally to the bravery, or dare we name it, the manipulativeness and savvy of the photographer, who entered a situation of physical danger, social restrictedness, human decay, or combinations of these, and saved us the trouble, or who, like the astronauts, entertained us by showing us the places we never hoped to go. War photography, slum photography, subculture or cult photography of the foreign poor, photography of, quote, deviance, photography from the past, W. Eugene Smith, David Douglas Duncan, Larry Burroughs, Dionne Arbus, Larry Clark, Danny Lyon, Bruce Davidson, Dorothea Lange, Russell Lee, Walker Evans, Robert Capa, Don McCullen. These are merely the most currently luminous of documentarian stars. W. Eugene Smith and his wife Eileen Miyoko Smith spent the early 1970s on a photo and text expose of the human devastation in Minamata, a small Japanese fishing and farming town, caused by the heedless prosperity of the Chiso chemical firm, which dumped its mercury-laden effluent into their waters. They included an account of the ultimately successful but violence-ridden attempt of victims to gain redress. When the major court fight was won, the Smiths published a text and many photos in the American magazine Camera 35. Smith had sent in a cover photo with a carefully done layout. The editor, Jim Hughes, knowing what sells and what doesn't, ran a picture of Smith on the cover and named him Our Man of the Year, Camera 35's first and probably only one. Inside, Hughes wrote, "The nice thing about Gene Smith is that you know he will keep chasing the truth and trying to nail it down for us in words and pictures. And you know that even if the truth doesn't get better, Gene will. Imagine it." That was a quote. The Smith's unequivocal text argues for strong-minded activism. The magazine's framing articles handle that directness. They convert the Smiths into Smith, and they congratulate him warmly, smothering his message with appreciation. Help preserve the, quote, cultural heritage of the mudmen in New Guinea, urges the travel editor of the Vancouver Province. "Why should you care?" he asks. And he answers, "To safeguard the value received for your tourist dollar. Canadians also love Disneyland and Disney World." He is asking for donations to a cultural center, The, quote, mudmen formerly made large grimacing pull-on masks to frighten their opponents in war and now wear them in adventure ads for a Canadian club. Quote, we thought we were in a peaceful village until, end quote. The mudmen also appear in the, quote, small room of Irving Penn's Worlds in a Small Room, an effete mimicry of anthropological documentary, not to mention in photos with the Queen. Edward S. Curtis was also interested in preserving someone's cultural heritage and, like other itinerant photographers operating among Native North American peoples, he carried a stock of more or less authentic, more or less appropriate, often less on both counts, clothing and accoutrements with which to deck out his sitters. Here, as with Robert Flaherty, a bit later, the heritage was considered sufficiently preserved when captured within the edges of the photographic record and in the ethnographic costume shops being established in museums of, quote, natural history. In Curtis's case, the photographic record was often retouched, gold-toned, and bound in gold-decorated volumes, selling for astonishing sums, and financed by J.P. Morgan. We needn't quibble over the status of such historical romances, for the degree of truth in them may, again, be more or less equivalent to that in any well-made ethnographic or travel photo or film. An early 1940s, perhaps, Kodak movie book tells North American travelers, such as the Rodman C. Pels of San Francisco, pictured in the act of photographing a Tahitian, how to film natives so that they seem unconscious of the camera. Making such photos heightened patriotic sentiments in the States, but precluded any understanding of contemporary Native peoples as experiencing subjects in impoverished or at least modern circumstances. It even assisted the collective projection of Caucasian guilt and its rationalizations onto the, quote, Indians for having sunk so and having betrayed their own heritage. To be fair, some respect was surely also gained for these people who had formerly been allowed few images other than those of abject defeat. No imagination, no transcendence, no history, no morals, no social institutions, only vice. Yet, on balance, the sentimental pictorialism of Curtis seems repulsively contorted, like the cariogenic creations of Julia Margaret Cameron or the saccharine poems of Longfellow. Personally, I prefer the cooler, more anthropological work of Adam Clark Vroman. That was anthropological, in quotes. We can, nevertheless, freely exempt all the photographers, all the filmmakers, as well as all the ethnographers on Scylla's to imperialism from charges of willful complicity with the disposition of the American Native peoples. We can even thank them, as many of the present-day descendants of the photograph people do, for considering their ancestors worthy of photographic attention and thus creating a historical record, the only visual one. We can thank them further for not picturing the destitution of the Native peoples, for it is difficult to imagine what good it would have done. If this reminds you of Riaz and Hine, who first pictured the North American immigrant and native-born poor, the connection is appropriate as far as it goes, but diverges just where it is revealed that Curtis's romanticism furthered the required sentimental mythification of the Indian peoples by then physically absent from most of the towns and cities of white America. Tradition, traditional racism, which decreed that the Indian was the genius of the continent, had nothing of the kind to say about the immigrant poor, who were fodder for the industrial Moloch and a hotbed of infection and corruption. Or consider a photo book on the teeming masses of India. How different is looking through it from going to an Indian restaurant or wearing an Indian shirt or sari. We consume the world through images, through shopping, through eating. Your world is waiting, and Visa is here. 120 countries, 2.6 million shops, hotels, restaurants, and airlines, 7,000 banking offices. For traveling, shopping, and cash advances, Visa is the most widely recognized name in the world. We're keeping up with you. This current ad campaign includes photographs taken here and there in the world, some authentic, some staged. Authentic was in quotes, by the way. One photo shows a man and a boy in dark berets on a bicycle on a tree-lined road with long baguettes of bread tied across the rear of the bike, rural France. But wait, I've seen this photo before, years ago. It turns out that it was done by Elliot Erwitt for the Doyle Dane Burnock ad agency on a job for the French Office of Tourism in the 50s. Erwitt received $1,500 for the photo, which he staged using his driver and the man's nephew. The man pedaled back and forth nearly 30 times till Erwitt achieved the ideal composition. Even in such a carefully produced image, Erwitt's gift for documentary photography is evident, end quote. Startlingly avers Erla Zwingle in the column Inside Advertising in the December 1979 issue of American Photographer, which also has articles, among others, on Bill Owens' at best ambivalent photos of mid-American suburbs, leisure activities, and work. Quote, sympathetic and honest, revealing the contentment of the American middle class, end quote, according to Amy M. Schiffman. On a show of photos from the Magnum News Photo Agency held in a Tokyo department store, quote, soon after the opening, Magnum President Burke Uzel flew off to hunt down refugees in Thailand while Glenn remained in Japan, garnishing much yen from assignments for the likes of IBM, Seagram, and Goldman Sachs, says EF. On Jeff Winningham's photos of Texas high school football, quote, inevitably one can compare him with the legendary Robert Frank, but the difference is that Winningham clearly loves the craziness, more on craziness later, he dwells upon, end quote, writes Schiffman. On Larry Clark's photos of Tulsa speed freaks, quote, a beautiful secret world, much of it sordid, and, quote, although there is plenty of sex, death, violence, anxiety, boredom, there is no polemic apparent, so it doesn't really matter whether or not we can trust these photos as documents. To see them as photographs, no more and no less is enough, end quote, remarks Owen Edwards. There is a Washington column by James Castle complaining that, quote, the administration frowns upon inspired photojournalism, end quote. And a page on Gamma photographer David Burritt, who arrived in Santiago de Chile a few days after the brutal putsch in 1973. On a government tour of the infamous stadium where people were detained and shot, he and other photographers, Burnett says, quote, the Chileans had heard many stories about people being shot or disappearing. This is in brackets. In a war, does one learn of death from hearing stories? In bracket. And they were terribly frightened. The haunting gaze of one man in particular, whose figure was framed by two armed soldiers, caught my eye. The picture has always stayed with me, end quote. We see a contact sheet in that image enlarged. The article by Yvette Benedek continues, quote, like most agency photographers, Burnett must shoot both color and black and white to satisfy many publications in different countries, so he often works with three Nikons and a Leica. His coverage of the coup won the Overseas Press Club's Robert Capa Award for exceptional courage and enterprise, end quote. What happened to the man, actually men, in this photo? The question is inappropriate when the subject is photographs and photographers. The subject of the article is the photographer. The name of the magazine is American Photographer. In 1978, there was a small news story on a historical curiosity, the real live person who was photographed by Dorothea Lange in 1936 in what became the world's most reproduced photograph. Florence Thompson, 75, in 1978, a Cherokee living in a trailer in Modesto, California, was quoted by the Associated Press as saying, quote, that's my picture hanging all over the world and I can't get a penny out of it, end quote. She said that she is proud to be its subject, but asked, quote, what good's it doing me, end quote. She has tried unsuccessfully to get the photo suppressed. About it, Roy Stryker, genius of the photo section of the Farm Security Administration, for which Lange was working, said in 1972, when Dorothea Lange took that picture, that was the ultimate. She never surpassed it. To me, it was the picture of farm security. So many times I've asked myself, what is she thinking? She has all of the suffering of mankind in her, but all the perseverance too. You can see anything you want in her. She is immortal, end quote. In 1979, a United Press International story about Mrs. Thompson said she gets $331.60 a month from Social Security and $44.40 for medical expenses. She is of interest solely because she is an incongruity, a photograph that has aged, of interest solely because she is a postscript to an acknowledged work of art. Mr. Burnett's Chilean photograph will probably not reach such prominence. I've never seen it before myself. And we will not discover what happened to the people in it, not even 42 years later. A good principled photographer I know, who works for an occupational health and safety group and cares about how his images are understood, was annoyed by the articles about Florence Thompson. He thought they were cheap, that the photo Migrant Mother, with its obvious symbolic dimension, stands over and apart from her, is not her, has an independent life history. Are photographic images then like civilization, made on the backs of the exploited? I mentioned to him that in the book, In This Proud Land, Lange's field notes are quoted as saying, quote, she thought that my pictures might help her, and so she helped me, end quote. My friend the labor photographer responded that the photo's publication caused local officials to fix up the migrant camp, so that although Mrs. Thompson didn't benefit directly, others like her did. I think she had a different idea of their bargain. I think I recognize in his response the well-entrenched paradigm in which a documentary image has two moments. One, the quote, immediate instrumental one, in which an image is caught or created out of the stream of the present and held up as testimony, as evidence in the most legalistic of senses, arguing for or against a social practice and its ideological theoretical supports, and two, the conventional, quote, aesthetic historical moment, less definable in its boundaries, in which the viewer's argumentativeness cedes to the organismic pleasure afforded by the aesthetic, quote, rightness or well-formedness, not necessarily formal, of the image. The second moment is ahistorical in its refusal of specific historical meaning, yet, quote, history-minded in its very awareness of the pastness of the time in which the image was made. This covert appreciation of images is dangerous insofar as it accepts not a dialectical relation between political and formal meaning, not their interpretation, but a hazier, more reified relation, one in which topicality drops away as epochs fade, and the aesthetic aspect is, if anything, enhanced by the loss of specific reference, although there remains perhaps a cushioning backdrop of vague social sentiments limiting the, quote, mysteriousness of the image. I would argue against the possibility of a non-ideological aesthetic. Any response to an image is inevitably rooted in social knowledge, specifically in social understanding of cultural products. And from her published remarks, one must suppose that when Lange took her pictures, she was after such an understanding of them. Although by now the cultural appropriation of the work has long since removed it from this perspective. A problem with trying to make such a notion workable with an actual photographic practice is that it seems to ignore the mutability of ideas of aesthetic rightness. That is, it seems to ignore the fact that historical interests, not transcendental verities, govern whether any particular form is seen as adequately revealing its meaning, and that you cannot second-guess history. This mutability accounts for the incorporation into legitimate photo history of the work of Jacob Riaz alongside that of the incomparably more careful Lewis Hine, of Ouija, Arthur Fellig, alongside Danny Lyon. It seems clear that those two, like Lange and the labor photographer, identify a powerfully conveyed meaning with a primary sensuousness, are pushing against the gigantic ideological weight of classical beauty, which presses on us the understanding that in the search for transcendental form, the world is merely the stepping off point into aesthetic eternality.
The present cultural reflex of wrenching all artworks out of their context makes it difficult to come to terms with the issue, especially without seeming to devalue such people as Lang and the labor photographer and their work. I think I understand from the inside photographer's involvement with the work itself, with its supposed autonomy, which really signifies its belongingness to their own body of work and to the world of photographs. But I also become impatient with this perhaps enforced protectiveness, which draws even the best intentioned of us nearer and nearer to exploitiveness. The Sunday New York Times Magazine, bellwether of fashionable ideological conceits, in 1980 excoriated the American documentary milestone Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, written by James Agee, and photographed by Walker Evans in July and August of 1936 in Hale County, Alabama, on assignment from Fortune magazine, rejected by the magazine and only published in book form in 1941. The critique is the same as that suggested in Germ by the Florence Thompson news item. We should savor the irony of arguing before the ascendant class fractions represented by the readership of the Sunday New York Times for the protection of the sensibilities of those marginalized sharecroppers and children of sharecroppers of 40 years ago. The irony is greatly heightened by the fact that, as with the Thompson story, the, quote, protection takes the form of a new documentary, a re-photographic project, a reconsignment of the marginal and pathetic to marginality and pathos, accompanied by a stripping away of the false names given them by Agee and Evans, Gudger, Woods, Ricketts, to reveal their real names and, quote, life stories. This new work manages to institute a new genre of victimhood, the victimization by someone else's camera of helpless persons who then hold still long enough for the indignation of the new writer to capture them, in words and images both, in their current state of decrepitude. The new photos appear alongside the old, which provide a historical dimension representing the moment in pastime in which these people were first dragged into history. As readers of the Sunday Times, what do we discover? That the poor are ashamed of having been exposed as poor, that the photos have been the source of festering shame, that the poor remain poorer than we are, for although they see their own rise in fortunes, their escape from desperate poverty, we Times readers understand that our relative distance has not been abridged. We are still doing much better than they. Is it then difficult to imagine these vicarious protectors of the privacy of the Gudgers and Ricketts and Woods turning comfortably to the photographic work of Dion Arbus? The credibility of the image as the explicit trace of the comprehensible in the living world has been whittled away for both left and right reasons. An analysis that reveals social institutions as serving one class by legitimating and enforcing its domination while hiding behind the false mantle of even-handed universality necessitates an attack on the monolithic cultural myth of objectivity, transparency, unmediatedness, which implicates not only photography, but all journalistic and reportorial objectivity used by mainstream media to claim ownership of all truth. But the right, in contradistinction, has found the attack on credibility or, quote, truth value useful to its own ends, seeing people as fundamentally unequal and regarding elites as natural occurrences composed of those best fitted to understand truth and to experience pleasure and beauty on, quote, elevated rather than, quote, debased objects, and regarding it as social suicide to monkey with this natural order, the right wishes to seize a segment of photographic practice, securing the primacy of authorship, and to isolate it within the gallery, museum, art market nexus, effectively differentiating elite understanding and its objects from common understanding. The result, which stands on the bedrock of financial gain, has been a general movement of legitimated photography discourse to the right, a trajectory that involves the aestheticization, consequently formalization, of meaning and the denial of content, the denial of the existence of the political dimension. Thus, instead of the dialectical understanding of the relation between images and the living world that I referred to earlier, and particularly of the relation between images and ideology, the relationship has simply been severed in thought. The line that documentary has taken under the tutelage of John Sarkowski at New York's Museum of Modern Art, a powerful man in a powerful position, is exemplified by the career of Gary Winograd, who aggressively rejects any responsibility, or shall we say culpability, for his images and denies any relation between them and shared or public human meaning. Just as Walker Evans is the appropriate person within the history of street photography to compare with Lee Friedlander, the appropriate comparison for Winograd is Robert Frank, who is compared with almost everyone, whose purloined images of American life in the 1950s suggest, however, all the passionate judgments that Winograd disclaims. Images can yield any narrative, Winograd says, and all meaning in photography applies only to what resides within the, quote, four walls of the framing edges. What can, in Frank's work, be identified as a personally mediated presentation has become, in Sarkowski's three, quote, new documentarians, Winograd, Arbus, and Friedlander, a privatized will-o'-the-wisp. Quote, most of those who are called documentary photographers a generation ago made their pictures in the service of a social cause to show what was wrong with the world and to persuade their fellows to take action and make it right. A new generation of photographers has directed the documentary approach toward more personal ends. Their aim has not been to reform life, but to know it. Their work betrays a sympathy, almost an affection, for the imperfections and the frailties of society. They like the world, in spite of its terrors, as the source of all wonder and fascination and value, no less precious for being irrational. What they hold in common is the belief that the commonplace is really worth looking at, and the courage to look at it with a minimum of theorizing. End quote. Sarkowski wrote the introduction to the New Documents show in 1967, in an America already several years into the terrors and disruptions of the Vietnam War. He makes a poor argument for the value of disengagement from a, quote, social cause, and in favor of a connoisseurship of the tawdry. How, for example, do we define the boundaries and extent of, quote, the world from looking at these photographers' images, and how we can be said to know it? The global claim he makes for their work serves to point out the limits of its actual scope. At what elevated vantage point must we stand to regard society as having, quote, frailties and, quote, imperfections, high enough to see it as a circus before our eyes, a commodity to be, quote, experienced, the way a recent vodka ad entices us to, quote, experience the 19th century, by having a drink. In comparison with nightmarish photos from Vietnam and the United States Dominican adventure, the work of Friedlander, Winograd, and Arbus might be taken as evidencing a, quote, sympathy for the, quote, real world. Arbus had not yet killed herself, though even that act proved to be recuperable by Sarkowski's ideological position. In fact, the forebears of Sarkowski are not those, quote, who made their pictures in the service of a social cause, but bohemian photographers like Brassai and the early Cortez and Cartier-Bresson. But rather than the sympathy and almost affection that Sarkowski claimed to find in the work, I see impotent rage masquerading as varyingly invested snoop sociology. Fascination and affection are far from identical. A dozen years later, aloofness has given way to a more generalized nihilism. In the San Francisco Sunday paper for November 11, 1979, one finds Jerry Nachman, news director of the local headline and ad station, saying, quote, in the 60s and 70s, all news radio had its place in the people's lives. What was happening in Vietnam? Did the world blow up last night? Who's demonstrating where? Now we're on the cusp of the 80s and things are different. To meet these changes, KCBS must deliver what's critical in life in a way that's packaged even perversely. There's a certain craziness that goes on in the world, and we want people to understand that we can chronicle it for them. End quote. Nachman also remarks, quote, our broadcasters tell people what they saw out there in the wilderness today, end quote. The wilderness is the world, and it inspires in us, according to this view, both anxiety and perverse fascination, two varieties of response to a spectacle. Imperialism breeds an imperialist sensibility in all phases of cultural life. A safari of images. Drunken bums retain a look of threat to the person, not perhaps as well as foreign prisoners. They are a drastic instance of a male society. The lumberjacks are prospectors of the cities. The men who seem to choose not to say within the polite bourgeois world of does of mean made up of or run by or shaped by or fit for women and children. They are each and every one an unmistakably identifiable instance of a physically coded social reality. The cynicism they may provoke in observers is far different from the cynicism evoked by images of the glitter world, which may end in a politically directed anger, directed towards change. Bums are an, quote, endgame in a, quote, personal tragedy sort of chance. They may be a surreptitious metaphor for the lower class. That's another quote. Lower class was in quotes. But they are not to be confused with the social understanding of the, quote, working class. Bums are, perhaps, to be finally judged as vile, people who deserve a kick for their miserable choice. But the buried text of photographs of drunks is not a treatise on political economy, on the manipulation of the unemployment rate to control inflation and give profits up and labor's demand down, on the contradictory pressures on the institution of the family under capitalism, on the appeal of consciousness eradicating drugs for people who have little reason to believe in themselves. The Bowery in Two Inadequate Descriptive Systems is a work of refusal. It is not defiant anti-humanism. It is meant as an act of criticism. The text you are reading now runs on the parallel track of another descriptive system. There are no stolen images in this book. What could you learn from them that you didn't already know? If impoverishment is a subject here, it is more centrally the impoverishment of representational strategies tottering about alone than that of a mode of surviving. The photographs are powerless to deal with the reality that is yet totally comprehended in advance by ideology, and they are as diversionary as the word formations, which at least are closer to being located within the culture of drunkenness rather than being framed on it from without. Okay, gotta stop right here. If you don't know, there's a lot of images in this text, so you should go look it up. I found it for free online. But to understand what Rossler is talking about right now, she's talking about her own series, The Bowery in Two Inadequate Descriptive Systems, which consists half of photographs of places where drunks would be, but they're not there. So you can see like bottles or like somebody's shoes sitting on the ground. All places in the Bowery where a person, you see evidence of a person being there, but they're not there. And then the other half of this piece, this series or whatever, is text, words on paper or whatever, slang for being drunk. So on the example that she gives in within one of the figures in this essay, it says, plastered, stuccoed, rosined, shellacked, vulcanized, inebriated, polluted. So at this point in the essay, that's what she's talking about. There is a poetics of drunkenness here, a poetry out of prison. Adjectives and nouns built into metaphoric systems. Food imagery, nautical imagery, the imagery of industrial processes, of militarism, derisive comparisons with animal life, foreignisms, archaisms, and references to still other universes of discourse applied to a particular state of being, a subculture of sorts, and to the people in it. The words begin outside the world of Skid Row and slide into it as people are thought to slide into alcoholism and skid to the bottom of the row. The text ends twice, comprising two series. First, the adjectives, beginning with a playful metaphor to describe the early, widely acceptable stages of intoxication, and moving toward the baldness of stupor and death. A second series begins of nouns belonging firmly to the Bowery and not shared with the world outside. Occasionally, the texts address the photographs directly. More often, if there is a connection, it is the simultaneous darkening of mood as the two systems run along concurrently. The photos represent a walk down the Bowery, seen as arena and living space, as a commercial district in which, after business hours, the derelict residents inhabit the small portal spaces between shop and street. The shops range from decrepitude to splendor, from the shabbiest of ancient restaurant supply houses or even mere storage spaces to astonishing crystal grottos, whose wrapped cherubim entwined in incandescent fixtures and whose translucent swans and fountains of fiber optic tubes, relentlessly dripping oil blobs onto dishes, radiate into the street. Above the street, the now infrequent flop houses and their successors, the occasional unseen living lofts, vary from mean raw space to constructed tropical paradises, indoor Boweries whose residents must still step over the sleeping bums in the doorway, and so are not usually the type who think of having kids. None of this matters to the street, none of it changes the quality of the pavement, the shelter or lack of it offered by the doorways, many of which are spanned by inhospitable but visually discreet rows of iron teeth, meant to discourage sleep, but generally serving only as peas under the mattresses of rolled-up jacket. While the new professional managerial urban gentry devour discarded manufactories and vomit up architectural suburbiana in their place, the Bowery is, so far, still what it has been for 100 years and more. Bottles and occasionally shoes, never flowers, are strewn on the Bowery, despite the name that still describes its country past. The photos here are radical metonymy, with a setting implying the condition itself. I will not yield the material setting, though certainly it explains nothing. The photographs confront the shop squarely, and they supply familiar urban reports. They are not reality newly viewed. They are not reports from a frontier, messages from a voyage of discovery or self-discovery. There is nothing new attempted in a photographic style that was constructed in the 1930s, when the message itself was newly understood, differently embedded. I am quoting words and images both. Sure, images that are meant to make an argument about social relations can, quote, work, but the documentary that has so far been granted cultural legitimacy has no such argument to make. Its arguments have been twisted into generalizations about the condition of, quote, man, which is by definition not susceptible to change through struggle. And the higher the price that photography can command as a commodity in dealerships, the higher the status accorded to it in museums and galleries, the greater will be the gap between that kind of documentary and another kind. A documentary incorporated into an explicit analysis of society and at least the beginning of a program for changing it. The liberal documentary in which members of the ascendant classes are implored to have pity on and to rescue members of the oppressed now belongs to the past. The documentary of the present, a shiver-provoking appreciation of alien vitality or a fragmented vision of psychological alienation in city and town, coexists with the germ of another documentary, a financially unloved but growing body of documentary works committed to the exposure of specific abuses caused by people's jobs, by the financiers' growing hegemony over the cities, by racism, sexism, and class oppression, works about militancy or about self-organization, or works meant to support them. Perhaps a radical documentary can be brought into existence, but the common acceptance of the idea that documentary precedes, supplants, transcends, or cures full substantive social activism is an indicator that we do not yet have a real documentary.